She had been given niacin for some nice, I think she had a kind of a like a stroke. And they do that for nerve regeneration, and they use it for other things now.
Mm-hmm.
So she said he would be so glad to know that. It was very feeble writing. But and I wrote her at the time.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You were talking about Mary Frank.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I wrote, in fact, my husband, I guess in that little note, wrote her too and said we'd love to have her come and visit us now that we were in the house. We thought it had been such a long time, maybe she'd like to come back. And she lived just in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote immediately and said no way could she do this because the emotion in that house is just still with her and she couldn't, having the shock of both husband and son's death and all in Madison, she just couldn't do it. But then I wrote her and said that I wanted to compliment her because she bought some perfectly magnificent tablecloths in Brussels, I think, that were purported to have cost $2,400, which to Madison was unbelievable, you know, in those days. And this would be 1924, about. And that I was using those, and so had Mrs. Fred, and that Mrs. Fred felt they were so valuable, she practically slept with them, and I did too. I kept them in my bedroom. And I said, it just shows that it was a good investment and was right for this house because they were huge. We could set 16 people around the table. And I said, I even may use them for my daughter's wedding, one of them for my daughter's wedding. And I thought she might like to know that. And I, at the same time, I had talked to Glossarian about the oriental rugs she had brought there, which some of them were still being used, on the stairway where hundreds and hundreds of feet had gone, you know.
Mm.
And I said, that also turned out to be a good investment. And I understand now what you felt like when you came here. This house was elegant, and you felt you had to do the right thing for it.
Mm.
And I just want you to know somebody appreciated it. So I think, you know, Madison wasn't ready for the Franks, that's all.
I guess that's true. She does seem to have been rather abrasive.
Well, she was.
Especially to women.
And I think to people that worked for her, too, probably.
Did you know her when?
Well, only, you know, just as a young bride, because I was married, you see, in 26.
Yes.
And the first time I went there was a University League affair, and the butler met us at the door. And this is another thing I told her. As you step into the living room in the president's house, so you go down three steps. And she had a butler at the bottom of those steps who said, I remember he said, Mrs. Albion, was for my name. And I went through the line that way. And but later, we had a woman who came in the receiving line, and the living room was usually in front of the fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
And people would be coming in from outside, maybe bright sunlight, and look toward the receiving line. I suppose it's an emotional thing to go through. Often the governor's wife or someone was there. And this woman stepped right off. She had her dark glasses on. She didn't see those steps, and she was a young woman. She fell flat, and luckily didn't hurt herself. But after that, I always had someone there. One of our committee members stand there and say, watch the steps. And I bet that's why Mrs. Frank had the butler, you know. It's just one of those things. But and he seemed more appropriate to her than a committee member, probably, which was my style. But so there were a lot of things we heard, and it was true that she probably had more perfume and cosmetics than most Madison women. But she came from New York, you know, and his spats.
Mm.
Were something to be talked about. But the day I went to this tea, I have to tell you that, because I don't think I've told this story publicly or in a tape or anything. Sarah Longenecker, whose husband is Professor Longenecker, you know, in the Arboretum, we knew each other in school, and he was a fraternity brother of my husband, so we were very close friends. The men were nothing alike, but very close friends. And Bill loved to hunt and fish and kind of didn't care a whoop about that. But we went to this tea together, and in those days the ladies had long chiffon gown. They worked at tea parties in the afternoon, about ankle length, in high heels. And you had that with your one good dress, and then mm-hmm. you had your business clothes and your at-home clothes. So Sarah, I had a blue chiffon and I had a brown chiffon when I can see them yet. And we went to this tea, and while we were there, it began to snow just terribly. You know, one of these quick, I think it was a spring snow when it mm-hmm. comes down, great big flakes, and it accumulated on the ground right away. Of course, we didn't have a car. We were going to walk home, and I said, we'll just ruin our dresses and our shoes, too. And it was a real calamity in those days. And as we got outside, we saw some boys on a big bobsled, and they were going to slide down the hill towards University Avenue. And we asked them if we could get on, and we folded up our chiffon dresses around our legs, and we rode clear down to Breeze Terrace.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And we went home and told our husbands that, and they said, tomorrow Mary Frank will see you lose your job if she saw you. But she didn't. I guess she didn't see. But anyway, that's the story. And you know, we thought afterwards, those boys were probably Tom Mendenhall and some of the boys that lived in the neighborhood that we later knew as, well, Tom became President Smith.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. So
how interesting. I didn't realize he was brought up here.
Yeah.
Did you entertain graduate students very much?
Yes, great many. And we had kind of had so many, you know, we had something like 89, I guess, that got PhDs with him. And we had parties each semester for them in our home when we had a small home. And then when we moved into our larger home, we had a nice rec room, and we entertained a great many.
Mm.
And
you enjoyed doing that?
Yes, I loved it. And he brought home all kinds of, especially after the war. You see, English people didn't travel too much before that, but many of the Europeans really didn't come this way much, but scientists began to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Nobel Prize people and all sorts of people, and some of them stayed with us, and some just came for meals. He found it difficult to, he hadn't the ear, what I call a linguistic ear, I don't know whether there is such a thing or not, but I mean, I have the ability to kind of communicate with foreign people.
Mm.
Partly my Latin, and I know a little Spanish and French, and I've been exposed to German, but I never really can speak it, and so I'm Norwegian. So I can seem to be able to put myself across to them and get from them. Well, he would take them through the lab, and he'd be so worn out explaining it, and he could do that because it was his science, and they could nod their head and they understood. But then he had to take him out to lunch, and I'd get this frantic call about 11:30. Can you get the kids fed and come down and have lunch with us at the union or the club or someplace? I've just had it. And then it was my job to take over. Well, you know, it wasn't always easy. I enjoyed it, of course, when I got there, but often I didn't have a car, so I'd have to hop the bus. We had just one car. But I did it, and I got lots out of it. And then we shared the fun of knowing that person together, which was nice.
So he really depended on
you
a good deal.
He did. I mean, the kids would tell you that, too.
Mm.
And I think most people who knew us. And that's why it took an awful chunk out of my life when he was gone. And I realized, I tell young people today now, be sure you have your own, do your own thing, because I never felt kind of in any way restricted me to anything I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he made lots of sacrifices for that. I was state president of PEO, which took me away a great deal.
What's PEO?
Well, it's kind of like a sorority. We own a college in Nevada, Missouri. There are about 215,000 of us now.
Mm.
You're chosen to belong, but it's a, their letters are secret, which I don't approve of. I don't care for secret stuff, but It really is a philanthropic educational organization.
Mm. Okay, well, you don't
have to. We have millions of, we spent millions of dollars for scholarships and bringing IPS and international peace scholars here and so forth. It's really a good group.
Mm.
Dorothy Knapman calls it the old ladies sorority, but that's not true. So it depends on whom you're talking to, but lots of wonderful people in Madison are PEO.
Mm-hmm.
You're chosen to belong, so it's kind of like it's already that way.
Would he discuss decisions he had to make with you, for instance, when he was chairman? And
yes, and the thing I didn't really hear as much about was the medical school mess, except that he told me some things, and he said, you must never tell these. No, you mustn't talk about them. And whenever we went out any place socially, the cocktail party, of course, had begun to be the in thing at the Bowers time. And he people would buttonhole either one of us. Mm. You know, how are you making out? And, you know, what's the latest? And they'd work at you to find out things in the social way that they would never ask you otherwise. And kind of cautioned me about this. He said, we just best not talk about it.
Yeah.
And after it was all over, he gave me a fur coat, the likes of which I never had, never wanted. And I even sent back once, and he quite heard about it, so I finally accepted it.
Huh.
And it's a mink coat. And then he said it was hush money. That's the only time I've ever done that like before, but that's hush
that's
money.
Because nice.
you were such a good scout about that. And I love to talk, as you can see, so.
I'm not asking you to say the things now, but are there things that you knew then that have never yet been known about that? Because it's still rather a mystery, that whole thing.
I think it is to everyone.
I mean, have you ever thought of writing up and it's all
I
dead now?
I have a suitcase full of clippings. I clipped everything that was in the paper. But of course now historians tell you that you shouldn't rely on newspapers because that's colored, and I know that's true.
Well,
the
thing is, one knows what's in the newspapers, but
right.
Did you know things that were not in the newspapers?
Well, I know some things, like Tony Carreri, for instance, came over to our house one night. And, you know, he was a very emotional, he was Italian, so he was a very emotional man. And apparently he wanted the deanship, which I don't think I had sensed before. I couldn't imagine anybody.
The deanship?
Yeah. Of the medical school, I think. And he couldn't stand Bowers. And he was on some important committee, which he resigned from, because getting out with him was, you know, where you couldn't be dean because it belonged to this committee, whatever it was, some administrative committee or something. So he promptly resigned from that. So that almost told us that he really wanted to be dean, which was such a surprise to Connie.
I should think so.
And he
he
said to Tony that night, he said, well, why on earth would you want to do this? You know, gee, you've got everything going for you, you have plenty of money, you know, you don't have any, and you have this in with getting money from foundations and so forth. Well, he came over to our house one night, and I never exactly knew what it was, but Connie said to me, Tony gets emotional if you hear any excitement. Get the coffee pot. So I went upstairs, and I greeted him when he came in, and actually I heard the man sobbing. Mm-hmm. And then I got kind of worried. I thought, well, you know, is that Connie or is it Tony?
Yeah.
And so I went downstairs and broke in with coffee, and Connie said after it was a fortunate thing because he'd just kind of gotten so emotional. And my son remembers that because he was in his room studying. He said he could hear through the register in his room just enough of it to know that Tony was pouring out his heart to Connie. He didn't really tell me the details, but he said it was hard for Dad, I know. And then, you see, Connie was in the middle of this thing. He was Eby's confidant, I suppose, when he chose Bowers.
Mm-hmm.
What Eby Fred knew that we didn't know, and I don't think my husband knew either when he died, but I have heard since from people out there, he was fired from the job in, is it Utah, where he was. And they were so glad to get rid of him. And the man that recommended him for our job has met one of my friends socially out there since, and he said, I feel guilty for Conrad Ovium's death, who was a man who was so great, because I'm the one that we wanted to get rid of him and recommended him for that university, and that's what made all the mess. So I don't know how much of this is true, but it's all hearsay, but you kind of put it all together. Anyhow, when he came, Edwin asked Connie, and he asked me to be nice to the Bowers and show them around. And they put him up at what they call the castle, the president's house. Fred's always called it the castle. And nobody does that anymore, and I'm kind of glad because it isn't that great, you know. Mm. They always had that feeling about it. And so I remember going up there. I think we took them out to dinner someplace, and then we went back up there. And I told her about the schools for the children, and I worked on her for... So we felt like we kind of talked them into coming, you know, the last ditch.
I see, yeah.
And so Kenny was loyal up until a point. You know, he felt, well, gosh, I helped hire this guy and that I helped push him over.
Well, apparently he did do some very good things for the school.
He's doing very well now. He's doing a wonderful job, I guess, with Macy Foundation. But, and then I could see Bowers begin to cultivate us, which I never had a lot of that on the faculty. And I didn't feel like we were, some people said, and I don't know when Connie died, who were your true friends and who were your other friends?
Yeah.
And I never felt that with any faculty people. I think probably because we came up through the ranks, they knew what we were.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew we knew them and they didn't have to do this.
Yeah.
Now, if you come here from away, it's different because everybody begins to say, who are your friends? I've heard them say that about the Weavers.
Mm-hmm.
The Weavers got to be very good friends with the Antoniases, and they weren't university people. Well, why are they so close? And I asked Roberta one day, because I was close enough to her, and I said, everybody's saying this, and I want to know myself, because I didn't know you knew them. She said, well, they wrote us before we came, and they said they'd help us any way they could. And she said they had no access to Grind, and they were nice people, so we became close friends. And so, you know, that's awkward, and I was out to O'Neill's the other night for dinner, and I could feel them feeling around a little bit too, you know, that it's kind of hard to know where, and they've been just great because they've taken up with so many nice young people. I think they're just great. So it's interesting, but to come back to John Bowers, then he would come up and complain to Connie and tell Connie one thing, and then Connie's students here was Van Potter and I guess wasn't Harry Weissman still alive then? Yeah, he died after Connie did. And see, many of those people were biochemists first and then they went into medical school. And they were all telling him, you know, this is so-and-so and he isn't doing this and he's saying this. And so Connie told me one time, I feel like I'm walking down a firing line with my friends shooting from one side and enemies from the other, and I don't know who's which, you know.
Yeah.
So that must have, but that's the only time when he slept. Well, people said he probably lost a lot of sleep. Well, he didn't, but he was a great sleeper, so I think just to go to bed and forget it was his. And he had a firm conviction always, I'm going to do the best I know in anything, and then I have to live with it. And that's what he did. And of course, the unfortunate part was John Bowers offered his resignation. And for some stupid reason, there was one regent. And I think I know the reason for that now, who voted against it. So then the regents thought they wanted it unanimous, so they refused the resignation.
Oh, it would have saved all the...
Yeah, it wouldn't have had all that year of horrid goings on.
Yeah.
And Connie trusted John. He thought he was telling him the truth. And we were in their house many times as dinner guests, and finally they invited us twice within 1 week, and I said to Connie, I'm not going out there again. I don't like this. They would have somebody there they wanted us to meet, and I just said, this is just too much, you know. Something's wrong here. And then he had these beautiful dinners down at the Madison Club. We'd be invited, and they'd have great barrels of shrimp and all these things that I knew cost a fortune. So one night I said to my husband, who pays for this? He said, I don't know. It's beginning to worry me. I said, well, you know darn well John Bowers isn't paying for it. And sure enough, he was using some funds he had that nobody knows where they came from, but they were not. But that was to get his way, you see, inviting the right people and so on. So there was a lot of shenanigan going on, and he kept... When he invited us to dinner, my husband got quite a kick out of Imogene. She was an army daughter, and she had wonderful stories, and she just amused Connie with all these stories. So they had a big thing going. She had a good mind. And I said sometimes, I'm jealous because you get to listen to Imogene, and I have to listen to you. But anyhow, make a long story short, we went to a medical school dinner out at the Eastside Businessmen's Club. When we got there a little bit early, we were just at the speaker's table, and I guess Connie always greeted them when they had one of these alumni medical things. And we got up there and went and looked to see where our places were at the table, and I was sitting down here with John, and Connie was sitting up here with Imogene and people between us. And then we turned to go and get a cocktail or talk to somebody, and I saw Imogene go up there and be shifting all these place cards around. So when we got up there, we were sitting right beside each other. Well, this was a thrill to us. We never got to in the presence of. So, but he said, "What's happened?" And I said, "Well, I saw Imogene up here, and she apparently didn't want to sit by you." And he said, "Well, it tells me something. You know, the boys have been telling me that, you know, that John tells her things, you know, that aren't true. And she now," he says, "I'm the bad guy in the whole picture, I guess." And then when we got up there, John shook hands with him, but Imogene refused to shake hands with either one of us. Well, we hadn't done anything to them. It really was the first hurt, and we never had anything like that in our life. Laura, really, we just never had ill will with anyone. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end, as I remember it. Now, whether Kenny got firmer after that, really saw the picture, but he saw this man was not telling the truth, and that hurt him. But I think he was just loyal because he knew he was brought here to do what he, some of the things he was doing that the medical school didn't like. And of course, Carr refused to always. Breathing down Connie's neck all the time, saying, "You've got to get rid of that man." And some of the medical school old timers were just.
Well, what did you think of him, of Carl Pusto?
Well, he's hard for me to understand. I see him a lot now, and he hates Mr. Harrington, and he refused to go to the Harrington retirement dinner, and he gave me hell because I went. And I said, "Well, I feel that my husband would have gone had he been alive."
Well, you're on good terms with
him. Yeah. Harrington's were kind of worried when I had to move out, but it's just one of those things. It was Nancy, and she doesn't understand, I think. And we're good friends now. They've had me to dinner and so on, but Carver can't stand him either, so he, but he's, after all, he's an 80-odd-year-old man, so maybe he's getting fuddy-duddy, I don't know.
Who were the people that were most helpful during that time, the associates that he could rely on, whose judgment he could trust?
People in the ag school were very dependable, and of course the graduate school, I think he, and his administrative committee, which was a wonderful one. I can't remember all the ones that were on, but Mark and, you know, the, and Ed Young. He appointed Ed Young dean of the LNS school. And
this, I'm speaking specifically in regard to the medical school issue.
Oh, medical school.
Who were the people that he could share the burden with?
I don't
with
think he really
trusted.
Began to, I think he began to feel he couldn't. He depended on Phil Cohen, and Phil Cohen, you know, took his bar's place immediately. And Phil had been a student of Kenny's.
Oh, had?
Yeah. There were just a whole bunch of those fellows that went on to medical school.
But Phil was in... was in medical school and chemistry. I know Phil. I mean, I've interviewed him.
And his own department. They were all, you know, Marv Johnson and all the people in that department were very dependable people, and they got around with scientists and medics enough to know, I think, and have some feelings, and I think they talked to him. But you see, Edwin pretended he now was against Bowers, but you know, Edwin Fred, so you know, it was really a strange thing, and I'm sure it did take its toll. I got a lovely bouquet from the medical school immediately, almost after I got him from the hospital, and Connie died. And I knew it was to say we're sorry, sort of, you know, sort of thing. So I sat down and wrote them right away, I think about the first people I wrote, a little note, and said I didn't in any way blame the that this must have been a...
Was this Ralph Hawley, or was it... No, let's see, who was...
Miss Phil Cohen, I think. Because Connie appointed him, I think.
Yes, he did.
But I immediately wrote them a letter and said that not to feel guilty about this, because he must have had the condition. He'd always worked too hard. See, it was the major artery of the heart.
Had it ever been...
No. except in the fall. He had high blood pressure the day they asked him to be president. It was the first he'd ever had high blood pressure. And we thought it was a momentary thing, you know, that the excitement of this.
Oh, I see.
But of course he was ill, too. He had this. And I think from then on he was
Well, he was taking some medicine, I've
yeah,
heard.
Yeah, right.
And what was that for?
Well, it was a diuretic. And then he was taking one of these high blood pressure medicines, Usurpin or one of those. But the doctor had stopped that because his blood pressure had gone down to normal.
I see.
And I was kind of glad because I thought he seemed sleepier a little. And Fred Arrington said that he thought from the time he took that medication he was never quite the same. He said it didn't spoil his work, but you could tell that he got tired easily. And the girl said in the office that he sometimes leaned on their desk when he talked to them, you know, which he hadn't seen before. He was so straight. So it could have been, you know, we were up north the week he died, and I said to him, how much longer are you going to be in this rat race, you know? And he looked up, and he was reading something, and he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, gee, we've taken 4 years as students through now. Why don't we call it quits? And he said, well, when Fred was president for 13 and a half years, you know. And I said, well, who wants to be that, you know? And he said, well, maybe another 4 years of students. And I said, okay, that's a bargain. I won't go any further than that.
So he liked being president.
Yeah, he did, after he got there, I think. And it was pretty hard to go back, let's face it. He had tenure in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But you've taken quite a little time out of your scientific laboratory, and things were getting more and more complicated.
That's
he
true.
Probably faced that, too. He planned to be a consultant for too many, and he was planning to go back. He was on a lot of boards when he was made president. And they paid very well, and we had to give all those up. Mm-hmm. So we really were taking less salary.
Mm-hmm.
Just think, $23,000 was the big salary they offered him.
Huh.
And I complained about that day in front of the regents. I just looked at him and I said, well, honey, that's less than we're getting now. Because he was on the Purina board, and they paid $6,500. And he was on the Northwestern Mutual Board. And Wisconsin Life had asked him, but he'd refused that because he thought there might be some conflict of interest there. And Johnson Wax people wanted him. So he had, and Purina said, they were just furious. They called up to congratulate us. And Connie said, well, I have news for you. Walter Rink says we have to get off the Purina Board. And they couldn't believe this, and they were going to fight it. And he said, well, there's no use. It's just, Wisconsin's always lily white, and we have to be. So they said, well, you have a place as soon as you finish to come back. You see, he was asked to be vice president at Purina because they were going into the dog food nutrition business, and he'd refused that. It was a fabulous offer. Neither one of us wanted to do it because we didn't want to leave academic life. So this was their alternative. They put him on the board, and he'd worked with Dan for scholarships for years. You know, he went the extra mile in all the volunteer stuff, too. And the nicest award to me, in a way, the nicest award that is given for him is given by Federation of Biological Scientists, and it's called the Outstanding Man in Nutrition and Public Service. It has to be the public service as well. Which is just what he would have liked, I'm sure. So, but as far as the Bowers thing is concerned, I guess it'll always be an enigma. And I've heard quite a lot. He married this Indian woman, you know, who is something in health, has some resources or has some pull with health funds or something. And they're doing a wonderful job, I guess, at this Macy Foundation. But he used to call me up and say, I'm Connie's bad boy. So he knew this, even before. One funny story I'd like to tell you. I think this is interesting, even maybe to record. Are you still recording?
Yes.
One day, my husband was going to Washington.
Wait. Okay. I'm just going to... So just tell the story. And then
it's not a long story, but We had a housekeeper at the president's house. We called the female dreadnought because she scared the boots out of us. You know, they were civil service in those days, and you couldn't fire them unless they murder you in their your bed or something. So we had this woman, and at first she sounded pretty good, but she began running our lives, and we got a little tired of it. And she was a devout Republican, and we had Governor Nelson as the governor then. And Connie and I had never, well, we were independents, frankly. So we never really talked much politics. We were in it, which stood us in good stead in that job. And Governor Nelson and Connie were quite close friends. They were, you know, Norwegians. So Grace came to work in this great big Buick car. She came from Mazamani or someplace out there. And she had a great big Republican banner in the back of it. And she parked it up in the parking lot up there. And Connie said, Grace, I wish you wouldn't. First off, nobody ever think of the help coming to work in a big Buick car. I obviously think it was ours. We had a little Chevrolet. And so he said, I wish you wouldn't, if you got to have that Republican banner wagon. And he said, turn your car around, put the front out. And she says, no, I want the people in the street to see it. She said, that's my right to have that. So we didn't say any more, but come Halloween. And I don't know who, whether it was my husband or my son, but somebody made way with the Republican sign, and she never could get another one. We were there. Well, the day that he was going to Washington, and he was going to be, golly, who was president then? It would have had to have been a Democrat. Kennedy, I guess. Mm. And he had a note. He always left his engagement pad we both used in the kitchen by the telephone, so I could tell where he was and he could tell where I was and so on. And he wrote that he was having lunch, I guess, with Kennedy or something. And so Grace reads this, you know. We didn't realize she was reading it all the time. Of course, when we went out, she had to know sometimes. But she said, I'm not sure that I want you going down and hobnobbing with the Democrats in Washington. And that irritated him, but he didn't say anything. And I said, well, sir, you're right. You bring all your papers in, and you, even at noon sometimes, you bring those papers in and put them in the kitchen table. And she sits out there and eats her lunch and reads everything. And I said, yeah, we'll just have to be more careful. So we agreed that we'd keep the engagement pad upstairs in my desk. And that day, Grace went home for the weekend, and he was going to Washington, and I was going to the Ladies of the Press breakfast. So we barely kissed goodbye. I didn't even take him to the airport. And he gave me this itinerary of where he's going to be. And I didn't look at it. I took it up, put it on my desk. And I got home just about 1:30 or 2. The telephone rang, and it was John Bowers. And he said, this is Connie's bad boy. And this was before things had gotten so bad. And he said, can you tell me where Connie is? And I said, no, I can't. I just don't know. He's on his way to Washington. Let go at that. And in a little while, I got a long-distance call from Mel Laird from Washington. And he said, do you know where Connie is? And I said, or he said, you know where President Delvium is. Well, I knew Melvin well, but I thought maybe I could get by with it. I never did anything like this in my life. My husband said, I guess we better get out of this job. You're getting to be an actress. But anyway, I didn't want to admit to Mel I didn't know where he was. So I said, well, if you'll call back in a few minutes, Mrs. Delvium will be here, and I can find out. Meanwhile, I had to go through this, and I couldn't find that darn thing. I practically went through the desk in that frantic until he called back. And then I said, hello, and he said, is this Connie? And I said, yes. I'm sure he recognized me the first time. I'm going to confess to him when I see him someday. But the whole thing was that he wanted to tell me that Tony Curry had been to Washington, had received this great big grant for cancer research. And he wanted Tony to be able to get home to tell Connie and get the credit for it before John Bowers could. And I said, well, I got news for you. John Bowers just called me about something. Mm. And he probably already knows. And he said, I'll be darned. And he said, but this time I had found the thing. So he called Connie. And Connie and I, he wanted Connie to call Tony and talk to him and compliment him. Well, it wasn't, but about 2 minutes later, the telephone rang, and it was Tony Curry in Chicago. And he wanted to tell Connie before he got to Madison so that John wouldn't get ahead of him.
Yeah.
But then in a little while, John called me back. And he said, I just have to tell you the good news. And here he had somebody in Washington that tipped him off. See, this is how devious he was. So, but that was my, and Melvin Laird, I really have laughed about that every time I read his name because, did he die? No. No.
I can't tell. I don't
know. I can't remember. Now I'm beginning to think that I thought I wouldn't get to tell him. Well, anyhow, Leroy Newberg got a big kick out of that because he was married to Melvin's sister-in-law, you know, so he thought that was funny. But so you did get it. A wife gets into a lot of things she doesn't intend to.
Well.
I think they want to keep it. This was before the awful dress that came later. And so he asked me if I would have lunch with him on his final day at the university, and I said yes, but I'm going over, I can't have lunch, but I'll meet you for a cup of coffee. I'm going to the center for luncheon at noon. This on tape.
Yes, I will have to repeat the beginning of it, but.
And so I met him on the steps of the Union. We were going into the Union to have coffee, and he had on shorts, and when we got inside, they forbid him going in. And it was quite embarrassing to me because the person who did it had to apologize to me.
Yeah.
Saying, Mrs. Albion, I'm sorry, but that's our rule. And I said, that's perfectly all right. So when we got outside, I really talked to this lad and I said, you did that on purpose because you had made a wager with me and probably a dozen other people that you could get into the Union with shorts on. And that he admitted it. He thought they'd let me by, you see. So Connie was having lots of fun over that. He said, well, you asked for it. Well, then he would find out when one or two Sundays when my husband was out of town, he would somehow find this out. He was so attuned to the campus and the goings-on, and I always wondered if he was one of our first somewhat less militant protesters. But he would find out when my husband was going to Washington or something, and then he would call me up and say, there's a good lecture, or the last lecture they used to have, you know, the professors had. And so I went to one or two of those with him, and then we often went down and had a cup of coffee at the Raskar. My husband never approved of that either, because he said he wants to be seen with you.
When he's president.
Yes, yes.
Hmm.
And, but you see, I had enough of this rapport with students. I had worked with, in fact, brought the campus Red Cross to the campus with Jenny Stump as president when she was in school. She'd be about 55 now, so I don't know when that was. But and we brought the blood bank to the campus with that. And we ran into all sorts of snags. Now, this was long before my husband was president. Well, not maybe 8-10 years before. And one day the kids decided they would like to have bloody red footsteps down Langdon Street into the Union where the bloodmobile was to be. And we got in trouble because you had to ask permission of the city to do that. They allowed us, but we got a little difficulty. Then one time we had a loudspeaker on a truck and they got in. Of course, I always got the brunt of it, you know, because I was the advisor. But that was good experience too. But that gave me this opportunity to be with many kinds of students. And I worked with some of the campus religious groups before Connie was president also.
Is it? Interpose here to
say
that.
I wonder if it's because we're so close to the towers.
Well, I hope. This is the second session of the interview on, and it's April 8th, 1983. And you were talking about, you started off with a story about a student who had befriended you when Connie was president. But would you explain to me what you're saying that you were an advisor to students, and you said that you had brought the Red Cross in, and I'd like to know more about that. Is that two different
Yes, two different stories.
Yes.
The Campus Red Cross started, I think, well, we brought the blood bank to the Red Cross in the 40s, I believe, and...
Who's we?
The Red Cross. I mean, they started the blood bank at the Red Cross. Before that, there had been, you could give blood at the hospitals, you know, and be paid for it, but this was a free donation. And I was publicity director at Red Cross for that those years, and so I guess I just thought the campus would be a great place because all the personnel, you know, the maintenance people and the professors and the students offered a wonderful opportunity. So we got students interested, and I think my own daughter was vice president once, and another girl I knew was the president. And students became very interested in this, and many of them had brothers and sisters in the war, you see, or who had been in the war, so they felt this was their job to give blood. And then the fraternities and sororities began a competition thing. Mm-hmm. So it turned out to be very, and I guess it's still going, I think. They still take blood in the Elm dorms area and in other places on campus. It was solely at the Union in those days. Well, the student that I wanted to tell you about that in the first part of the tape was, he had some connection. He grew up in Chicago and he had some connection with a bottling company, or his father did. So he saw a way to get to our house on a weekend, Sunday or Saturday, when my husband was home. He would bring him some mix for his drinks, but we didn't drink that much. But, and this used to annoy my husband too, because he always got in at the door by bringing this gift, and whoever went to the door, you know, didn't have the heart to turn him away. Mm. So he got to us a great deal, and he didn't agree with Connie's policy always, and he would be quite frank to talk this over. But after my husband died, he wrote me that he was always kind of ashamed now. He was kind of just feeling his way, and he really liked to be around people that were in administration, and so this was a way. And I guess I was the gimmick, because I was a mother and fell for this. So often my husband would say to me, he thought I had a very keen sense of people, and if I didn't like him, he was a little bit cautious, and he'd always say, put your antenna up, mother, because I often found an insincerity in a person that would come through later.
Mm-hmm.
And not particularly in his, ever in his own field, but in appointing administrators and so on. He would say, well, I guess you were right, you know, you had some feeling. I think John Bowers was one of it, the man that came from the medical school. So he began to trust me a little bit with this, and then I felt that very, burdensome, because I wasn't that astute, but it was fun to learn to know people, and I guess that was my fort. I was a little more anxious than he was, perhaps. I was very shy as a girl, and so was my husband, very shy. So it's kind of a strange combination that we people think, in any article I've ever read about the two of us, they say I was the outgoing one.
Hmm.
And I think that's probably true, but I think he was more self-assured than I ever was. And he gave me that self-assurance. And the first big job I had to do after he died was in the fall of the year he died, in July, and this was in October. I suddenly, on my way, I was all dressed to go in a long dress and officiate at this big banquet of the 50th anniversary of the Civics Club. And I suddenly went cold. I thought, you know, I don't think I can do this without Connie. You always said, oh, you can do it better than I can. And I stopped at the cemetery on my way, and just, I didn't even get out of the car, but I just sat there a minute, and I went on, and that was it. And I don't believe in going to cemeteries very much. I've never been one to sit at a grave or put flowers on a lot or any of that. So this sort of surprised me. But I still felt the need of his support. And I guess we both felt that. And that was one of the challenges of our lives together, that we could support each other. Now, what did you want to talk about next?
Well, just to, you said you were a student advisor at one point. Were you officially?
Well, I was the Red Cross student advisor, yes.
Oh, I see. That's that, yes. Okay. That's
I was never, I wish
but
I
then you said of religious groups.
And then I worked with the campus religious groups, the ecumenical. They had a movement here to have all campus student work under one head.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a statewide thing, and I was on that committee with ministers from Madison. We had Catholic and not Lutheran as I remember it, but most of the other churches were represented.
When was this?
Well, this was after my husband died, as a matter of fact, because I was living in this house. Well, I remember we had a conference at Green Lake, and we didn't get home till 3 in the morning, and my father was walking the floor, wondering where I was at that time of night with a bunch of ministers. I was the only woman. So, we had what we called, when I was in college, we had what we called Religious Emphasis Week, when they brought wonderful speakers like Harry Emerson Fosdick or someone Gilkey or someone of that ilk to Madison, and all the different faiths participated, and it would be maybe a 3 or 4 day session.
Mm.
And students would go. And then there came this complete apathy to any kind of religious affiliation, and they wouldn't like to say when they registered, you know, what faith they belong to. I mean, it's the pendulum swings one way. I think they're coming back now. We've seen so many more at our church. But I remember one of these men, and I don't even remember which one it was, who came to speak at this Religious Emphasis Day, and I met him at the Northwestern Depot. He came from Chicago. And I took him down State Street in the car. And he said, oh, this is the street I've heard so much about. And I said, well, what have you heard? And he said, well, for one thing, I am anxious to be in Madison. I've heard that Madison and Geneva, Switzerland, and Cambridge, England, are the three of the best places to live. And I said, well, I feel very proud. I've lived in Cambridge, England, and Madison, but never in Geneva. I've been there. And then he said, whoever had told him this, had told him he must walk along State Street, and that it was such an intimate street that it was narrow enough that you could see in the shops on either side. You could hear what people were saying on almost either side of the street. And that was true in those days. Now, they widened State Street after that, and it changed the face of it some. But I hadn't ridden down it for a long time until a week ago Saturday night. I went to a concert in Milwaukee on a bus, and the bus came down State Street, and we all were so happy to be where we could look in the shops again. So it's interesting, and we stopped walking State Street during the protests, because that wasn't wise. But State Street, when I was in school, was so interesting because the engineers parade, when they threw eggs at people, and that was our big excitement, you know. That was instead of protests, we had this kind of thing. And then the lawyers would retaliate. And then we had the bonfire down on the lower campus, and that was always a big night. So it was always the focus. And then we had hockey games on the lower campus.
Mm-hmm.
And after dates, we'd always stop and watch the hockey game, you know, after we'd been to the movies or someplace. So it was it's always been an interesting street. And I think it's great that students have it now pretty much to themselves.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I'm sorry, you're saying that Connie always felt that that both of you should go to all the funerals.
Mm-hmm. Of faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
And if we felt that we knew both of them, we'd go to call, usually. And if he had a faculty member in the hospital. He always, and I don't mean his just his own faculty, but this was when he was president.
Mm-hmm.
He would stop in, and E.B. Fred did that too. I'm sure my husband may have gotten that idea from him. But it was that intimate a thing. You knew your faculty that well. And I think most of them called him Connie.
Mm-hmm.
And his feeling was that, you know, they were our family, sort of. And I guess I had the same feeling about students. Now I think students would resent being thought of that way or mothered or... I remember the Milwaukee Journal said I was a motherly type in the newspaper, and I didn't really like that very well, but I guess it was true. And of course, I had a student in the university at that time, so his fraternity was at our house a lot. They gave their Christmas party there, and we said there could be no liquor because the university was not supposed to serve liquor in the house.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only the university house, it was state-owned houses. It was on the statutes, and of course, that was hard to decide, but we decided we didn't want to charge liquor to the university, and that this was a good out. So we told the boys, if they have a party here, there can't be liquor. But they were going out to dinner afterwards, so that didn't bother them. So they came, and it was the year we went to the Rose Bowl. We had a big ice punch bowl with roses in it and goodies. And they danced, and they had a wonderful time. And there was only one vote in the fraternity against coming to our house because of the liquor thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun. And Bob had an apartment at the back of the house so students could come up the back steps. We never knew who was coming in the back door, even when he wasn't home, you know, some of them. And we had some game things in the basement, so they'd go down there and play. And we felt the house belonged to the university, and we were just sort of living there. It isn't the most comfortable feeling, but you get used to it. I'm glad it didn't go on longer, really. I think 4 years is about long enough to live there.
Did it come to 4 years then, mm-hmm, altogether?
Mm-hmm.
58?
Just 4 years. He just took through, we always had a freshman reception when the students came with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a senior reception. And so we had just finished the senior reception, gone through the commencement and all that when he died, you see. It was July, but we'd had my class reunion for breakfast, and I think we'd had his class for something, so that had been a busy, busy time. But one time we tried having the freshman reception at the president's house, and that was kind of a disaster because those poor people, it was a, you know, it was one of these Wisconsin days when it couldn't decide what it wanted to do. And they were standing outside, and lines for a long time. And I'll remember one very funny thing about that. One of the women parent came, and we had a tiny little powder room downstairs. And it was so tiny, it was sort of made out of a closet, and I had gotten a trailer toilet and a trailer washstand to fit in there. And the only way they could do it was to put the toilet so it faced the door. Well, this woman went in there and sat with her, she had a hat on, and she sat in that toilet for just ages with the door open, and finally the help went to her and said, you know, we have to keep this for other people. And she said, I don't care until I get my turn in the line, I'm gonna sit here. It's the only place to sit. So she sat in full observation of everybody. Of course, I didn't know any of this. I was in the living room in the reception line. So there were lots of tales like that were funny, but you get all kinds of people, and she got through the line and got to shake hands with the governor and all, and that was nice. So, but I think we had like 2,500, and that's a lot of people to go through a house. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten what the last count was, but Professor Harriet in the Spanish department's wife's name was Margot. And she had managed these receptions pretty much for Mrs. Fred. And with the help of Ann Minahan, who was the head of the union, social and student affairs. And Ann worked with me, and so did Margot. And they had worked out just beautifully. So they had lines with flowers, you know, and they had harps and music going, and beautiful. It was really a beautiful event, except the people had to stand in line. That was hard. Mm. But they stood so that they could see the whole thing, which was kind of fun. That great hall at the Union lends itself to that. And but I guess that's about the end of that kind of thing. It was just getting too big. And they, of course, the father and mother bring their lesser children that hadn't yet gotten to college mm-hmm. age, so mm-hmm. it got to be a big thing. And yet it was very satisfying to me. One of my best friends now is a girl we received with her parents when she was a freshman from Chicago, and she married and lives here, is on our faculty, her husband is. And then we took her through her senior reception, and we quit. So she always thinks we were her special president. Mm. And when Connie died, the student prom was all, summer prom was all set up, and the kids canceled it. They felt that badly. And I called the girl who was in charge and said, don't feel you have to do that. He would want, you know, everything to go on. She said, we just don't feel in the mood. He worked with us on it, so. There were a lot of things like that. They gave a bean supper, students did, to raise money for a portrait they wanted to buy. They had Aaron Borod make a portrait for the Union, and they thought they could raise enough money. They only got part of it. And he suddenly said, well, why don't I give the rest of it to the university? Mm, so it's good. At the Union. Mm. And there were just so many things the students started. They had a symposium the year after. So it showed that we were really close to students, I think, and that to me was the biggest part of the job. And it's not that way now, but it's a different class of people, and it's a different world.
You, after you had to leave the president's house, you presumably didn't have much chance to have much to do with students, is that right?
No, not really. This is maybe why I like this Board of Visitors job mm-hmm. so well, because we did interview students, and mm-hmm. and the students still invited me to things, many of Chadburn when they had a tea and things like that. For a long time, I was invited to their Christmas tea. And I went for, well, I knew some of the students, but mm-hmm. then it gradually. And the last time I went to the, to a function, I went to the Sigma Alpha Iota formal dinner at the Union. And I wore my fur coat, which my husband had given me, and was a mink coat, which was much too minky for me, but he wanted me to have it. And that was the evening that the Dow Chemical people were setting up their whatever they were going to do yes. the next mm. day in the lounge of the Union in the first floor there. And I went to the desk to check my fur coat, and two of these fellows came and just looked me up and down, you know. And I said to the check girl, why was that? And she said, well, you represent the establishment in that coat. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Elvin, I wouldn't wear it over here again. I never did. Mm. And but that gave me, a woman alone, a different feeling about being over there sometimes to student functions. And that hurt, you know. And I felt the same way one night when I walked through the Ratskeller. I'd always gotten off at that entrance, you know, and gone through the, and they looked at me, and I just didn't belong anymore. And I suppose when maybe it was always that way, and I didn't realize it because I knew I did belong. I don't know, but it's a strange feeling.
This was in the late 60s. Yes. Maybe. Well, that would have been a difficult period. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there were lots of things happening at the Union then. But I think that's about the last, why I went to the Union. Always had that beautiful party, you know, at Christmas. I went to that several times, and I've been invited to. And my husband's fraternity has been awfully good to me. They've had me down a number of times. They have a picture of Connie over the mantle or someplace. So I've had that many contacts. But it did change pretty fast. But then my own children grew up then, too. Mm. I worked with international students. Long before Connie became graduate dean, we were made honorary members of the International Club, which was a very going thing. And of course, there weren't so many students in those days on campus from other countries, and we worked with them. And we sponsored an Indian girl who came to this country and became a
PhD and married a PhD, and they're both in Washington doing wonderful things. She's with the National Institute of Health. And then we had a Norwegian girl live with us. So I had that kind of context. I think Bob counted one time 13 different students live with us during the years. So I was always with kids. And I loved them, you know. But that was the most fun of the job, I think, the relationships with faculty and students and the people who came here.
I have to